Trying to kind of preach a Christmas sermon can be a little bit challenging. Not because you don't know it, but because you do know it. And to try to find new insights into it, hopefully, is something that I'm trying to do today. Let's put it that way. You know, you really can't improve on or change the story in any way to make it better. We may add our human side to it that we think would make it better, but really, we can't. It's so unusual that God became a human being, the Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. There's got to be something fascinating about that to anyone to hear the retelling of it every year. And I tend to think that the retelling of it every year perhaps just renews our faith in it, renews perhaps what it means to us. It's kind of a story with a long shelf life. It is the beginning of Christ's redemptive work. And maybe its shelf life is because it carries such personal meaning for us. It carries so much hope for all of us who believe it. And hope just has a long shelf life itself, I think. At least I'd like to think that it does for each one of us. Now, what I want to do this morning, perhaps, is maybe a little different for you, because I want you to transport yourself. I want you to transport yourself to the world of angels. And the reason I want you to do that, because this is one of those areas in the Christian faith where your imagination can get to work. And I don't mean by imagining fanciful things that never happened or never will happen. I'm talking about fanciful things that did happen and using your imagination to put yourself there. To see the part of the angels in this grand story. Okay, and angels play such a significant role here that it does stir our imaginations to just think, what's happening here? These beings from another dimension have kind of invaded, okay? We like to think perhaps in fanciful terms what that was like. Maybe we like to think in fanciful terms what it's like for them, what their world is like being around the spirit beings as they always are. One of the things that I think we gain from this perspective, seeing how much the angels are involved here, is to recognize God's presence is at work in the birth of these two men, John the Baptist and Jesus. If we see nothing else but that, we've gained a great perspective on what our faith is. And quite frankly, why shouldn't we believe another world exists beyond this one? People try to deny that. We kind of try to look at the world in sort of scientific, materialistic terms. But deep inside, intuitively, we sense there's something more than just what's here, what we can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. There's something more. And that's what we learn. If we accept at face value, and I see no reason why we shouldn't, that these angels really were at work in these people's lives, then we can say there's something more at work here. To see the hand of God in the births of John and the births of Jesus is kind of to be on the road to faith. So we've heard the story many, many times, but if we interject ourselves into this where the angels are, maybe it won't be so ordinary to us anymore. And I don't think there's anything ordinary about it, but just maybe to get a new perspective helps us see that. The first thing I would like us to see is this, and think of it as directives from heaven. Two conceptions. We're not even up to the births yet. We're at the conceptions of two individuals. And what we see here in the very first one is in Luke chapter 1, where an angel, who's given a name, by the way, Gabriel, comes to Zechariah in Luke chapter 1, verses 11 through 19. Now, the angel identifies himself in verse 19 already after Zechariah sees him and he's paralyzed. Somewhat, you know, a certain amount of fear. And I've often wondered in a fanciful sort of way how I would react if I were to first see an angel and recognize that it was a being from another dimension. I would certainly feel two things. I would feel certain fear, and then I would be like, okay, what does he want from me? What's he going to ask me to do? And I go, well, you know, there's always some little catch that seems to be happening when the angels appear to people. But what might it have been like for a messenger? And he even says here, I stand in the presence of God. we have an angel here who's sort of God's special messenger. And his name is Gabriel. Do you guys remember the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life? Of course, there's angels involved in that. I seem to remember at the beginning of that story, they have to talk about why this is all happening. And the picture, the way they did this, and this was made back in 1948, so the technology wasn't quite the same as it is today, but they pictured the sky with the stars. And of course, one star was real bright, and they had the voice of God there, and he was calling in one of his other angels. And of course, you see the star come over to the other star, and he says, "Yeah, boss, what do you want?" You know, and they talk in terms of the way they probably spoke to, you know, superiors at that time. And God is telling the one angel that I've got a guy down there who's discouraged, and he needs a little bit of help. And so they have to get his guardian angel. And when Clarence, who happens to be the name of the, in fact, it's Clarence Oddbody is the name of the guardian angel. When he comes in, he doesn't come in straight. He comes in, he's meandering all around, you know, and you find out later on, he sort of doesn't seem to quite have his head on straight. But he's the guy they're going to send down there. That may have been an early perception, but it's the writers of the show were trying to transport you into the world of angels. As weird as it may have been the way they tried to portray it, I think it's kind of humorous, of course. And then we find out about Clarence later on and what he does and so forth. I'd rather think that it's more like what you would see in the book of Revelation chapter 4. That gives us a very realistic picture of what it was like in heaven and what the angels were doing and how they were constantly singing the praises of God. And God's up on a throne, and the throne is kind of like on fire. And you can go back and read Revelation chapter 4, you get that picture, but you're still transported into another world here, because here's Gabriel. The world kind of comes to humanity here. It comes to Zechariah. And this story becomes really different from any of the pagan myths, because we're given it happening in a time and a place with a particular group of people. A lot of the pagan myths, they don't include all those historical details. They just say, well, this kind of happened here, this happened there. This makes this myth, if we can call it myth or at least story, it really makes it different. Because it happened in a time and a place with a particular group of people. Here with a very particular couple of individuals. Zechariah. And we see in verse 12 that Zechariah, when he learns about that he's going to have a child, when he sees this being standing next to the altar, he is struck with fear. He has a pretty typical reaction to something that doesn't seem like it's from this world. But despite his doubts, we are told that he's going to have a child. He is told he's going to have a child. And perhaps the angel here, well, not perhaps, the angel definitely has in mind a prediction that came about just near the end of the Old Testament. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. That's what Zechariah is told about the child that he's going to have. He's going to be that individual. Despite Zechariah's doubts, we learn later on that he and Elizabeth do in fact become parents. But Gabriel's not done. Gabriel's got another message to perform. He's got another message to deliver. And we find that out later on in chapter 1 about the conception of another birth. This one a little bit more unique. One of quite a different sort, we are told. But I'm sure that Gabriel here has in mind Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 7, where we're told that a virgin will be with child. Or is it maybe Isaiah 7:14? I think that's what it is. I don't know why I'm getting that mixed up backwards. One of those places back there, we're told that a virgin is going to be with child and have a child. And that's what happens here. That's what Gabriel's bringing to Mary. Once again, you see, the hand of God is at work. You know, if you have doubts about all that stuff, at least get the idea that the hand of God is at work here. And that is extremely significant. But like any of us encountering a being from another world, Mary herself is also troubled. Verses 29 and 30. So she's a little bit afraid of what's happening here. She is told that her child is going to be holy, the Son of God, verse 35, which I'm sure she doesn't quite fully understand yet. All the terminology, perhaps, is really not perhaps fully understood by the people who first encountered it, but later on they would put the pieces of the puzzle together and they would understand just exactly what was happening. We're told in the book of Hebrews, chapter 1, verses 1 and 4, that this child, this son that was born, he's the exact image of God himself. He is God, which I'm sure, you know, she would have thought, I'm going to bear God? That would never have made sense to her. But kind of that's what's happening. And so our imaginations begin to run a little wild here. Certainly the imagination of people who would have encountered these angels, their imagination is probably just sort of churning up a little bit. What is happening here? And as we shift gears a little bit into the next part here, where we look at all the human reactions to the birth, we see that their imaginations also are kind of churned up. And so we turn to chapter 1 later on in verses 57 through 66, and we learn about the birth of John, the first conception we heard about, the first conception that Gabriel came and said was going to take place. And in verses 57 through 66, we read a couple of little details here. First of all, in verse 58, we read that all the neighbors gathered for the birth. It's a big occasion, isn't it? The birth of a child is a very great occasion. It's a very joyful occasion. So all the neighbors came and participated in that. But a certain degree of consternation happens here because Elizabeth wants to give the child a name that is not a part of their family history. And that's just not done in that culture. And so this was